You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the author of a new book makes the case that we should use technology to make our future more human and less virtual. Now, hundreds of protesters stormed Brazil's capital buildings in Brasilia this past Sunday in support of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro. Riots come just 1 week after former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's re-inauguration as Brazil's new president. Here in the U.S., the Brazil riots have drawn some comparisons to the January 6th insurrection after the 2020 election. Cynthia Arnson is a distinguished fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program. Cindy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to join you.
Can you give us a little bit of the context coming out of Brazil's election and leading up to this weekend's riots?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, Lula da Silva won the election in the second round by a very narrow majority, you know, mere percentage points in the single digits, 1-2%. This was the closest election in Brazil's history. And the president who was defeated, Jair Bolsonaro, had vowed that there would be fraud. And this is something that he has hammered on for years, really, to detract from the credibility of Brazil's electoral system. And he refused to concede. He did leave Brazil. He did not appear at Lula's inauguration. Typically, one president hands the presidential sash to the next. He instead is in Florida. And the lead up, I think, was that he had encouraged his protest, his supporters to protest. There were people camped out outside military barracks asking essentially the armed forces to come in and stage a coup to prevent Lula from taking power. And those people showed up in Brasilia, the capital of the country, on Sunday. In many ways, an assault that was foretold, that authorities did know about and did precious little to actually stop.
Now, these fraud claims, as I understand, Bolsonaro's party did okay in the legislative election, but he lost the presidency. Does there appear to be any legitimacy to these claims of fraud?
There really there is no legitimacy to these claims. As a result of his claiming fraud for so long, the military actually was among those that examined the electoral system. The United States played a role as well, looking into the possibilities that that code would be hacked or somehow the results would be manipulated. And the electoral system was seen to be completely reliable. And this has been the conclusion since the 1990s when the system was put in place. And, you know, as we've seen in other elections, including here in the United States, the claim that an election has been fraudulent, has been stolen from you, can really stoke supporters who communicate with one another on social media, on certain apps, and start spinning all kinds of conspiracy theories about how the fraud took place and what kind of government Lula was going to install once he was inaugurated. And of course, these false claims and the fake news phenomenon is well known in Brazil and other parts of Latin America around the world. And it is, I think, a serious threat to democracy in the Americas, but in other places around the globe.
And protesters, pro-Bolsonaro protesters, have called, as you touched on the military to take over, reinstitute the former president. This has happened before. There's a 1964 military coup, as I understand, in Brazil that ultimately led to a military rule of the country for, two decades? Are people looking back at that and thinking, yeah, let's do something like that again?
Well, his supporters, I think, clearly want that. And Bolsonaro was very much in favor of the military during his time as a legislature and praised the coup and praised the military government, including its human rights abuses. As you say, it was in power from 1964 when it seized power from a democratic government and didn't give up power until 1985, so 21 years. The military has not acceded to those calls. It has resisted those calls. The military was not involved in trying to put down the protest. And the real question, I think, and what is being investigated by the current Lula government is the complicity or the charges or the possible complicity of the federal police that are in charge of guarding the presidential palace and the Congress and the Supreme Court. And, you know, you mentioned early in the interview, the January 6th events that took place in the United States 2 years ago. This in many ways was more severe because it was the seat, it was the Supreme Court, it was the presidential palace and the legislature, you know, the equivalent being not just the U.S. Congress, but the White House and the Supreme Court as well. So this and the vandalism, I mean, if you've seen the images on the internet, they're quite horrific. The kinds of damage that was done, including to very important works of art that were hanging in those buildings. Luckily, no one was there, so people were not injured. But the accusation, I think, is that somehow these busloads of protesters were able to get through. Their intent was clear. Police did not stop them. There have been pictures of police chatting with the protesters rather than trying to stop them, of, you know, buying a drink instead of doing anything. And so these are all issues that the Lula government is looking into. There have been about 1,500 people arrested. Those are the reports. I'm not sure of the exact figure as of now, but they are clearly going to investigate and prosecute the rioters. How easy that will be, I can only imagine. But they are also looking into the way in which pro-Bolsonaro political figures, including the governor of Brasilia, as well as members of the police or intelligence services, may have, at a minimum, acquiesced in allowing these people into the building. In direct, I think, contrast to what we saw with the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, in which the Capitol Police were actively trying to keep the violent mobs from entering the Capitol building.
Talking to Cindy Arnson from the Wilson Center's Latin American program, looking at the riots in Brazil's capital, attacks on multiple government buildings there over the weekend. Cindy, stepping back for a moment, why we in the United States might be interested in what's going on in Brazil. This is the second most populous country in our hemisphere, a pretty substantial economy in its own right. How important is Brazil to us here in the United States?
Brazil is incredibly important to the United States. As you mentioned, it is the largest economy in South America. It has the, as many people probably have heard, the Amazon rainforest, which is an absolutely critical part of the effort to fight climate change and to allow the forest to regenerate. During the previous government, the Bolsonaro government, deforestation took on unforeseen dimensions. Lula has pledged to dial back on that. But, you know, in terms of a lot of U.S. goals, whether it's the defense of democracy or the effort to combat the global changing climate, Brazil is a very important partner of the United States. It's also an important actor on the world stage, in whether that's in the UN or, you know, as a member of various coalitions of developing countries. And, you know, there are lots of economic ties between the United States and Brazil. Brazil has China as its main export partner, mostly because of commodities. But what happens in Brazil and the attack on democracy in Brazil is something that really is of great interest to the United States and certainly of interest to the Biden administration, which has made the defense of democracy in the Americas and around the world a real priority of its foreign policy.
We've mentioned the parallels between January 6th and what happened this weekend in Brazil. Is there a sense that people who organized this, people who participated, were inspired by what happened on January 6th? We know some of the people in the U.S., the Steve Bannons and Ali Alexanders, have encouraged these kind of protests, called in some cases for martial law, a military coup in Brazil. Is this U.S.-centric, or was there some inspiration there?
Well, you know, it's in the broadest sense, Bolsonaro drew inspiration from Donald Trump, a president who he admired greatly, who some have rumored, you know, he's in touch with now that he's in Florida, in Orlando, and as last reported, in the hospital. But the storming of the Capitol, the stoking of the false narrative around a stolen election, I mean, these are things very much taken from the Trump administration playbook and Trump and his close advisors. There were, you know, during the riots, you know, Steve Bannon was on his network and whatever, and did not call on people to stand down, appeared to be encouraging all of this. So I think that the really kind of globally detrimental effect of what took place in the United States is reflected in what just happened. There's certainly a demonstration effect that is very corrosive to democracy and not an export that we should be particularly proud of.
We just have a minute or so left, Cindy. Now, that 1964 coup I mentioned, as I understand it, the U.S. was supportive of that coup. This weekend's events, what has been the response from U.S. leadership in the international community, again, just in our last minute or so?
Sure. There has been swift condemnation, not only from the Biden administration. Joe Biden actually talked to Lula, pledged U.S. support. It was long reported that Lula would be invited to the White House. The invitation is there now for February, for early February, just in a couple of weeks. But not just the United States, Latin American countries, including countries that are not democracies, condemned this because, after all, Lula is a leader of the left, a man of the left. Countries like Bolivia, like Cuba, that don't normally come out in defense of democracy, condemned what took place in Brazil, as did the United Nations and countries in really around the world. So the condemnation has been swift and complete. And even within Brazil, the immediate public opinion polls show that the vast majority of Brazilians reject the violence that took place in the seat of government in Brasilia.
Cindy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks, Tyler.
That's Cindy Arnson, Distinguished Fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program, joining us for a look at this weekend's events in Brazil, the attack on buildings in the Capitol there. Coming up, the four candidates running for state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin met yesterday to make their case ahead of this spring's election. We'll hear from one of the moderators of that forum about what we heard. That's coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. This spring, the ideological balance of Wisconsin's Supreme Court is up for grabs. Four candidates are running to replace conservative Justice Patience Rogensack, who is part of a 4-3 conservative majority. Two of those four candidates will advance past the February 21st primary to the general election on April 4th. Candidates took part in a forum yesterday put on by WIS Politics, where they shared their judicial visions and weighed in on some key issues in the state court system. Emily Fannin is the state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. She co-moderated yesterday's candidate forum. I talked to her earlier today. She joined us from the state capitol building. Before we meet the candidates, can you set the stage for us with what's at stake in this big state Supreme Court election?
Well, of course, as we just wrapped up one big election, statewide election in November, everyone is now has their all eyes set on this state Supreme Court race. And what's really at stake is a lot of issues that we've already seen the state's high court already weigh in on, things like redistricting when it comes to the use of ballot drop boxes. And of course, the big lingering question going forward is when, as many are expected, the state's criminal abortion ban to be heard eventually before justices this year. Of course, that issue is still in the lower courts, but many people predict, just as the Attorney General Josh Call does, is that the justices will have some big decisions depending on reproductive rights in the near future.
Now, this is officially a nonpartisan election, meaning the candidates don't run as a Republican or a Democrat. In practice, we always know who the conservative-backed and liberal-backed candidates are. Let's touch base, starting with the two who have been more or less backed by the conservative side of the state. Who are those two candidates?
So those two candidates are former state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly, who is one conservative, and the other one is Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Duro. She, of course, presided over the Waukesha parade trial and became very famous for her how she kind of handled that case. So she's trying to go off of her experience with that. Meanwhile, Daniel Kelly, even during the forum that we held this week, he also kind of reminded voters that, you know, I've already been in this position. He served 4 years on the bench. It was then Governor Scott Walker who had to fill a vacancy and appointed him then, but he lost in 2020 to a liberal-leaning candidate who is now serving on the bench.
And then we've got two candidates in this primary who are seen as backed more by Democrats and liberals. Who are they?
Right. That is Everett Mitchell, who is currently a Dane County judge, and Janet Protasiewicz, who is a currently at Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Those are the two liberals who had some interesting, highlights during yesterday's forum. But I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, let's get into that forum now. Now, it's tough with judicial candidates sometimes to get them to say anything, because the right. argument is, well, I don't want to say anything because I'm going to be a judge. I might have to hear this case. That said, one of the things you tackled is, as you mentioned, those redistricting maps. What were candidates willing to say about what they thought of the current state of affairs?
Right. I will say some were a little bit tight-lipped and others were not, which were the two liberal candidates. Now, it's important to note that every candidate up there did pledge to be fair and impartial if elected. But we know there's a lot of outside money that is poised to be spent. And I'm talking millions of dollars invested in this race that will be coming from the state Democrat and Republican Party. So while they say they're going to be fair and impartial, some of the highlights that we heard is the liberal candidates, Mitchell and Protasiewicz, both indicated on how they might rule on controversial issues such as abortion and redistricting. Specifically, I would say Protasiewicz was one of the most outspoken on there, calling the current maps that were enacted by the Supreme Court, called them rigged. And she said that a few times, really just letting people know that I don't think this is fair. And, you know, she said those are her values, but that was a clear sign that of how she might rule if she was elected to the bench. Now, Mitchell also said those maps are, you know, unfair right now. They don't fairly represent everyone, kind of comparing the differences between statewide elections and legislative and congressional races across Wisconsin.
Talking to Emily Fannin, state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. She co-moderated yesterday's candidate forum featuring the four candidates in Wisconsin's state Supreme Court primary this election season. You asked candidates also about what they think a bad decision was by the U.S. Supreme Court decision. I think even maybe the worst decision. What kind of things did they point to?
So we had Mitchell and Protasiewicz both talk about Roe v. Wade being overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. They specifically answered that question. Now, we did not see Judge Duro did not answer that question, but we did reference in her question to her in her judicial appointment application. She did cite the overturning of a 2003 anti-sodomy law in Texas as the work decision by the high court. Meanwhile, Kelly referenced a 2005 decision where the court ruled that the government has this authority to take privately owned land and turn it over to a private developer. So he stood by that. Duro didn't really answer the question when we mentioned what she wrote in her application. And that was also something we saw kind of throughout the forum, that she kind of had prepared scripted remarks in front of her. And when we asked about specific cases, even about, say, Second Amendment Amendment rights. She didn't answer, but then kind of went back to her talking points of how she plans to be, you know, fair and impartial if she were to be elected.
Now, Emily, it's no secret. Elections here in Wisconsin can get a little bit heated. How would you describe the tone of the candidates and the way they talked to and about each other at this forum?
Well, when I watch these forums and when I listen back to them too, you try to find those aha moments. Now, this wasn't really a debate style, so we didn't see any of the candidates really take jabs at one another. The only highlight that I did see was Kelly did kind of knock Protasiewicz for when she said that her values, you know, when she mentioned that the redistricting maps were rigged. So Kelly kind of took a dig at her saying, you know, if someone is already talking about their values, you know, we already kind of know how they're going to rule on a specific case. But other than that, I mean, everyone kind of kept to their same talking points. I will say during opening remarks, that was kind of, I would say, one of the strongest from all candidates because, you know, not a lot of people, you know, we have a lot of political Whigs and politicos and here at the state capitol, a lot of people that are really invested in this race. But, you know, voters just got done with November's election. So I think now that they're getting kind of a sense of where these candidates stand and what their, you know, issues are and what their campaign's all about, I think it's now going to start gaining a little bit more traction for people to kind of learn a little bit more about the candidates ahead of the February 21st primary.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Fannin is the state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. I talked to her earlier today about the race for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. She joined us from the state capitol. You can find a link to the video of the candidate forum we mentioned there, which Emily co-moderated. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up on Thursday this week, are you a worrier? Do you worry? Does it keep you awake or distract you while you're awake? Well, help is on the way. We'll talk to a psychology expert who says we may not be able to stop our worrying, but we can do it better, more productively, and in ways that can give us less stress. Am I talking about you? Let us know about your worry habits and what you do about it. Maybe you have a question for our guest that we can share on Thursday. Maybe we can get an answer for you. Let us know. Email now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know how you have learned to worry better or how you want to learn how to worry better. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, retirement planning has changed a lot in some ways over the years. Join Kate and her guest to get some advice on the new rules of retirement. And that's whether you're days away from retirement or decades away, there's some advice there for you. You can get started right now. Ask your question at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or let us know what you've been doing to help us save for retirement, the challenges you faced along the way. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're like most people, you probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about your local community's official flag. But some people do. A national flag design group just issued grades for communities around the country that have designed or redesigned their official flags lately. Wisconsin doesn't come out so good. As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there were 9 Wisconsin communities with flag designs since 2015. 7 of those got a failing grade from the North American Vexillological Association. What gives you a bad grade? Too many design elements, too many colors, words, and seals, too. The communities with failing grades were Franklin, West Allis, South Milwaukee, Kenosha, River Falls, De Pere, and Janesville. Hayward got a C for its flag. Madison pulled an A. I don't know, looking at it, Madison's flag is simple, sure, but maybe a bit boring. And some of those F flags may not follow the rules, but they bring some local color. Check out your local flag. You can often find them on a local government website. Let us know what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, will AI kill art? More and more images are being made using artificial intelligence. Some artists are worried how easy it's become for a computer to seem at least as creative as a person. Join the conversation today at 6 on 1A+. Now, when we think about the future, we often think about technology, more smart devices and artificial intelligence making our lives more digital and virtual. But our next guest says that the time we spent more isolated during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic reminded us how much we value human interaction and getting to spend more time with other people face to face. He says it's an opportunity now to think carefully about what we want technology to do and not to do for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how we use, maybe misuse, our online technology coming out of learning at home? For some people, working at home, what did you like about that? What did you not like? Did you find yourself really yearning for more human connection? How have things changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Sachs is a journalist and freelance writer whose work appears in outlets like the New York Times, Bloomberg, and the New Yorker. He's the author of 5 books. His latest is called The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to before COVID. You write about this notion, sort of a techno-utopian idea that we're going to get more digital stuff, more virtual stuff. We should use as much of it as we can, and it's going to make our lives better. I'm oversimplifying, maybe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think this is something that goes back decades, if not even before, right? It's this human cycle of invention, which is a very, I think, a particularly American thing, that there is a new technology that's coming out, and this is going to make such sweeping changes to our lives that it's going to completely reorganize the way we live in the most wonderful colored way. Or the flip side of it's the kind of dystopian Terminator version of that. And for decades, this was kind of the defining way we spoke about the future. But in the past couple of decades, and especially really the past 10, 15, 20 years, with the sort of advent of the internet and smartphones and all the things that have come with it, it's really kind of captivated every level of our discourse around the future. And to the point where, you know, the term "the future is digital" was just kind of this accepted gospel of the way we were going to live and sort of our predestined path forward.
And here came COVID. And the heart of your book is looking at this as this accidental experiment where we tried this digital future on for size. You break it down to a lot of different realms in our lives. Big picture, though, what did we learn?
Well, I think all of us around the world, except for some people in New Zealand for a few months when they kind of skated away before it hit them, we every one of us was kind of forced to live or interact in the key parts of our life through digital technology almost exclusively for weeks or months or even years at a time, depending on where you live. I mean, if you're in China, you're just coming out of this right now. And so while before the sort of notion of the digital future was this far off, you know, fantastical kind of utopian thing, all of a sudden it's April 2020 and we're all living through this. We are all working online unless our job required our bodies to be there, whether you're sort of an ambulance driver or a doctor or a construction worker or, you know, cooking in a restaurant as an essential worker. Every child from kindergarten through to, you know, graduate school of university did their schooling online for, again, weeks or months or years. And everything. I mean, you know, the way you would interact with family, you would have a reunion with your friends, you would shop or you know, have a restaurant meal. All of it was done through screens, through technology, through the internet, right? That digital future of like, in the future, you're going to live at home. You're not going to have to wear hard, difficult pants. Everything you're going to do is going to be on your screen. It's going to be this wonderful thing. You're going to exercise. You're going to pray. You want to see a concert. That concert is going to be beamed right to your fingers. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, right. This is it. This is what I'm living. And I think for most people, that got old pretty quick. We saw the limitations of that. We saw where that was insufficient and where the analog, by which I mean the non-digital spaces, relationships, and interactions of our life actually seemed more valuable. We came to realize that. And that's really what this book is about, what we learned from that experience and where we saw those limitations.
Talking to David Sacks about his new book. It's called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to share your experience, maybe early in COVID days, doing a lot of things online that you might have done in person, were there things you thought worked better? What did you miss? Did it reaffirm the value for you of seeing people in person, doing things, going to work in person, if you're one of the people who worked at home? Love to hear your experience, your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, let's go to work now. This is one of the chapters in your book where many people, not all, but many people were working online and discovered, you write, that we're missing something. What were we missing?
Well, I think it was all the things that are generally not thought of as quote unquote work, right? We think of work, and we were talking about sort of knowledge-based work. In short, work you can do on a computer in an office or at home, basically. And so we think of work as like, I must do these tasks on these programs in order to get paid my salary or my money or to achieve the things I need to achieve. And all the other stuff, the commuting time, whether you're driving or taking the public transit into work or walking, the coffee on the way there, the little meetings you might have that take some time in a room, or the short conversations at the water cooler or the coffee machine or on your way to lunch, all those are just kind of these extraneous things. The office, the sad potted plants, the neon lights, or wherever it is. Maybe you work in some cool place that's like a loft in Milwaukee or whatever. These are just kind of like the external trappings. We just got rid of that and got right down to the work, the sort of the meat of it, right? The economic activity. But actually, all those other things are the things that people miss. And it's funny, it's a lot of what people said is it was the things that they often complained about. Oh, another, you know, oh, Rob, another birthday. Like, come on, do we really need, you know, another sad cake in the lunchroom? Oh, Rob's, you know, making another joke again in a meeting. Oh,
no, people okay, never miss that.
Yeah, no. You know, oh, someone's writing something on a whiteboard. And actually, what people realize is the things that they missed about work was not the specific task they could do. That they could do, you know, you could work on an Excel spreadsheet at home. You could work on an Excel spreadsheet in a park. You can work on an Excel spreadsheet in an office. It was all these other things that added up to something bigger. It was these physical touch points, the different information that you pick up when you're walking through a space. There was someone I spoke to, his name's Andres Hofbrauer, and he's an occupational researcher and in New York. And he studied, you know, the offices of architects, and he defined it as what was missing was this thing called embodied cognition, which is this larger understanding you get about ideas when you're in a shared space working with other people. And sometimes it's passing by someone's desk and seeing something pinned up or seeing something there. It's the snippets of conversation you have. All those things are the things that people actually realized had value, but only once they were sort of taken away and they were forced to just subsist on the tasks at hand.
Your solution here, you say we're having debates about should people who can work at home or work in the office or what percentage or whatever. You say that's not really the right question. And some of this applies to the non-work things too. You're hoping that we take this experience and just rethink, like, how do we work? Why do we work this way? What questions do you hope we start asking?
Well, I think the first is you know, what is the actual value of the spaces we have or the work we're doing, right? Or those relationships, and really assess them in a very critical way, because we can do many jobs remotely and we can do many things without having to commit to leasing a giant office space, and so on and so forth. But, you know, we're still stuck inside this 19th century industrial revolution model of, you know, you will go to this place and we will have your body in this place for this many hours. And for each of these hours, you will pay this many dollars. And that is productivity. And the reality is many people can work, you know, and do the same task in less time, in a greater amount of time. And most people, I think, just want to be treated as adults and given some sort of autonomy, which is a really difficult thing for large organizations, for bosses, for managers, for owners, sort of relinquish. But unless we have those conversations about what does it actually mean to allow people to work in the way that works for them? We'll never get beyond the sort of simple idea of like, is the office the future? Is working from home the future? Is it 3 days a week and Mondays, Rob, you're coming in, and Tyler, you're coming in, and Susan, you're coming in, but then the other team's coming in on Wednesdays. How are we going to coordinate that? Okay, we're going to have an all hands on Thursdays. So come with your best ideas on Thursdays. It's this sort of false narrative and this sort of dead end street that most businesses are trying to deal with now. And I think we need to move beyond that to say, what are the parts of work? What are the parts of this that we actually realize have a value by doing in person together in one space? What are the parts of it that it doesn't really matter where or when or how someone does it, as long as that work gets done? And how can we find a mixture that gives people that balance, that gives us the best of both worlds? Because I think the idea before is maximum efficiency is going to equal maximum productivity. And so if we can have everybody working either, you know, under my thumb while I watch them at the office, like some bad boss from a 1950s movie, or any movie really, or the opposite of everybody go home, everything's remote, and this is the most efficient way to do it, and then people are unhappy or disconnected in that way, what's the best mix? And that's going to be different for every organization, every group in an organization, every individual who's working. There's no one easy answer. It requires that experimentation. But this is what people are going to be figuring out for the next, I don't know, how many years or decades.
We're talking to writer David Sacks. His new book is The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You could join in at 800-642-1234. In person versus online, what works for you? What doesn't? What do you prefer when it comes to work, learning, having fun, hanging out with people, seeing a show? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to David Sacks, author of the new book, The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you worked or learned or taught or had fun, recreated online a lot with the start of the pandemic, were there good things about it? What did you miss about interacting with people in person? Was it a big relief when you could do that again? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I am a teacher, and we did find out the hard way. Teaching is very much a human interactive person-to-person kind of activity, which is going to explain an awful lot of why we're seeing the educational COVID deficit in our kids today.
Kevin, thanks for the call. David, you're a parent. You've got a chapter about this.
Kevin, first of all, thank you for everything you do. I can't imagine how difficult it was for you as a teacher during those years. Certainly, I observed it with my own children who were in elementary school. I think this is you know, one of the areas where it was crystal clear where the future lies, and it doesn't lie in remote streaming video education. There's been billions of dollars poured into it. The best universities, the best minds worked on creating this future of school being remote and virtual. And I think what we saw is that it was a dismal failure all over the world, whether it was wealthy countries, wealthy schools, middle income. It didn't really matter. It didn't matter if it was public schools or private schools. It didn't matter if it was kindergarten universities. It really was a failure, and the data has come in to show that on learning loss, on engagement, on emotional engagement, on the mental health of children of different ages. And the key lesson is there is a difference between information delivery and teaching and education and knowledge. Information delivery is what technology, whether it's radio or television or the internet, does really well. If I want to find out a particular fact about something or learn about a particular thing, I can find that information out very easily. It is at the tip of my fingers. I can type it in and watch videos and see all sorts of things about it. But education is built on relationships, human relationships, the relationships between a teacher like Kevin and their students, the relationships between the students and their peers and each other, and the relationship between the school and that community that it's in. And I think if any of us think back to the best teachers we had or experiences at school, whether it's, you know, kindergarten, or if you went to, you know, University of Madison, Wisconsin, that experience is all about those human relationships. I don't remember very much of the particular facts or figures or things that I learned in school. I remember my teachers. I remember the peers. I remember that learning. And those relationships are actually what allow us to take the information that we're being taught and turn it into a deeper knowledge about being a human in the world. And I think we saw just how insufficient digital technology is in doing that. You need people to sort of facilitate that relationship, teachers like Kevin.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. We're talking to David Sachs. His new book is called The Future is Analog, How to Build a More Human World. Back to your calls. Barbara is with us in Fort Atkinson. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I think we have a generation gap, at least in the working world. I am 73 years old, and I work full-time, love my job, love the people I work with. And when I was home for 15 months during COVID, I was just so lonely and missing the people that I work with. And I ended up working like 16 hours a day because I could not separate my work time from my home time. But the people, the younger people, I would say maybe 30 and younger, they love working from home. And when we try to hire people, that's the first thing out of their mouth. Well, can I work remotely? So,
Barbara, thanks for sharing that. You're not alone, I think, in your experiences there. David, what do you think?
First of all, I'm qualified to speak on this subject because I'm someone who's worked from home for himself his entire career for the past 20 odd years. So I'm no expert in workplace anything. And that's my sort of caveat. I think what's interesting is there is this what I call generational generalization that people make. And I sort of hear it in Barbara's comment, which is that, well, the younger people, and it's usually anyone, you know, in their 30s or younger, right? The dreaded millennials, the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, I guess, that are coming up next to them. The assumption is that because they are a generation that has grown up with digital technology, this is kind of what they want. This is their desire. But the facts don't really bear this out. If that was the case, then all those children who were learning online would have thrived. And actually, they were the ones who really hated it the most. And you're seeing that in many workplaces. It's actually the younger people who want to go in for mentorship, to build relationships, to learn, because they live in a house with a bunch of roommates and they don't have the space to work. And conversely, I've heard from many people of Barbara's generation, the baby boomer generation, they love working from home. It's the greatest thing. They don't have to drive. It's more convenient and so forth. So it really is down to people's individual circumstances. And I would caution against making generalizations based around people's age or demographics or other sort of large things. You know, when you ask people, why do you prefer to work from home, or why do you prefer, you know, using digital technology rather than an analog alternative in this sort of way, it comes up in their answers. And that answer often has very little to do with their age or particular demographics. It's individual preferences, it's circumstances, it's, you know, I have a cat and I have to stay home with the cat, or I have young children, or I live really far from somewhere, or so forth.
Barbara, thanks for that call. Just a couple minutes, David, left. There's another solution here. The reaction that, though, the problem here is that our digital world wasn't good enough yet, and so we have projects like Meta, formerly Facebook, saying we'll have virtual reality so we can look like we're sitting in a classroom with our classmates and the teacher, or David, Rob, we can sit at a virtual coffee shop and talk. That is what's going to make this all work. You have thoughts about that?
Thoughts indeed, if not comments. The first one is, you know, if you're Mark Zuckerberg and you look at what's happening and you see how so many of these things failed and people were clamoring to get out back into the real world. And your solution is, aha, I know what the solution is. The screens were not close enough to our eyes. And we actually just have to physically strap them on. And then, you know, you can be an eel and I can be an octopus and we can be having this conversation, Rob, in sort of Wisconsin Public Radio virtual reality. It's almost a stunning lack of imagination to sort of see things that way. And the proof is in the pudding, right? Meta's stock is you know, down tremendously. And that's because no one is opting to do this. This has been out for a year. You know, no one's buying these headsets. I think at some point it's like on average a day, there's, I don't know, 200,000 people on this Meta thing using it. How many people listen to the show on average? Just asking.
Well, fewer than that, I'll admit.
Fewer than that.
But let's, yeah, but that's just Wisconsin.
You know, let's say the you know, a Wisconsin Public Radio aggregate listenership is probably greater than the number
sure.
of people worldwide using this virtual reality future, which bodes well for the future of public radio, I think, but doesn't bode so well for the future of this purported virtual solution. And why is that? Because we're still human beings. We still get our greatest meaning and connection and joy from the real analog world. We want to touch things. We want to smell things. We want to see people. This is the freedom that we were clamoring for during those years and months of lockdown. And I think that's the hard lesson that we have to take with us, right? We tested this out. We kicked the tires. We took it for a test drive. Parts of it worked, but that as an entirety of a vision of a future is not one that most people want to go forward with.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's David Sacks. His new book is called The Future is Analog: How to Build a More Human World. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the newest drug approved for use in early stages of Alzheimer's and what we know about its potential benefits and its limitations, plus how humans and cats got together. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll visit children's museums around the state to find out what's new for families and get your suggestions for some of the best winter activities for kids. You can share yours right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.